Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to On the Ball with Rick Bucher. Here's your host.
Let's send it over to Rick Bucher.
Rick Bucher.
This is On the Ball on the United WeCast Network, and I am Rick Bucher. You can see me on FS1, hear me on Fox Sports Radio, and you can read me on the Fox Sports app and at foxsports.com. You can also follow me on X, the former Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at Rick Bucher. I'm a lot of places, but there's only one place you can hear me talking about story angles and perspectives that you are not likely to find anywhere else, primarily but not exclusively involving the NBA, and that is here. So we're about to have a couple of five-car pileups, if you will, both within this episode and in the upcoming week or weeks with so much to talk about with the play-in games and the playoffs all happening. So I'm going to try to pack in as much as I can. I've been trying to do a weekly podcast. We're probably going to bump that up to at least two a week for the next couple of weeks, but we shall see. First, in this podcast, before we get to the main topic, a bit of interesting news when it comes to Lonzo Ball, the Chicago Bulls point guard who hasn't played for the last 2 years, basically. I'm hearing that he's got a legitimate shot at resuming his career starting next season, or this summer, actually. Now, I don't know about any of you, but I had my doubts that this would ever happen, and it's still a ways away from happening, but I've been hearing some positive news for the first time in a while. 2 years away from the game with a knee issue that seemed hard for anyone to actually define will raise doubts. Klay Thompson missed 2 years and came back, but it was because of two distinct separate injuries 1 year apart. And they were injuries easily identified with a track record of players returning. A torn ACL in the 2019 NBA Finals, and then a torn Achilles tendon as he was preparing for the 2020-21 season after missing the entire 2019-2020 season. With Lonzo, it's been the same knee and the same curious issue with no signs of progress. And, well, I guess now there is. He still hasn't played, what I'm told is he still hasn't played full contact, but he's running and jumping and he's going through individual drills pain-free. I'm told he's been diligent about his weight training and is jacked in a way that he had never been previously, and that there is no soreness or pain in the knee after he works out. Now, there's always going to be sore muscles from ramping up conditioning and drills, but there's no lingering pain in the knee. And that might be the most promising news, because for the longest time, the pain simply wouldn't go away. Now, that still leaves several important hurdles. One, can he sustain the current ramp up without setbacks? Can he get back to playing in contact and not thinking about the knee? And is he sound enough once he starts playing again and we get all the variables that come with playing in live action and against physicality? Will his body, or will his body not, instinctively compensate and possibly overload some other joint or ligament in a way that I would imagine happened with Klay, and the reason why he went from tearing an ACL to tearing an Achilles tendon? So, and then the other element is, can he get back? Can Lonzo get back to the all to the NBA level explosiveness and agility that he had before. And it amazes me, and it would amaze you if you've seen it the way I have, how razor thin the difference is between having the requisite athleticism to compete in the NBA versus being a guy who is scuffling in the G League hoping to find that extra tenth of a second again. It really is that minute. And you, sometimes you can compensate for it with size, and depending on how nuanced your game is, how skilled you are, you can lean on other elements to still be an NBA player. But a big part of what made Lonzo an effective player, the reason the Bulls went after him as their point guard, was obviously, number one, he could defend. And two, he could get to places with his length and pass the ball. It's not like he's a pure shooter. It's not like he has great footwork in playing in the post. He needs his athleticism to be what made him an NBA player. So we'll see if he ultimately gets back to that. But wanted to share what I'm hearing, which is the first positive news about Lonzo that I've heard in easily over the last year. And I have to say, you know, there's a part of me that my heart goes out to anybody who is prevented from doing what they love to do, particularly at a young age. And if it's not anything that they did to cause their own demise, that only makes it worse. We can all say, well, you know, it's lucky that he had what he had and plenty of money and all that stuff. That's easy to say from the outside, but when it's your life, when it's your dream that seems to be going away, that's tough. All right, so one more thing before I get to the topic du jour, which is the impact the 2024 NBA draft is already having on team roster decisions and why the draft is being forecast as being potentially the worst ever. I want to throw something out to my listeners that I'm genuinely curious about, and it's inspired by the LeBron James, J.J. Redick podcast that started up several weeks ago. The podcast is called Mind the Game, and its stated mission is to cut through all the debate-type conversation and talk about the nuances of the game as a way to educate basketball fans and deepen their appreciation for how the game is played at the highest level. Now, it struck me as an odd pairing between LeBron and J.J. They didn't have any previous relationship. This isn't Channing Frye and Richard Jefferson or guys that had either known each other in college or were long. I mean, Dwayne Wade and LeBron James doing a podcast would have been more likely for me. So part of this, I know, is it's strategic on both of their parts. For JJ, it raises him to a platform that he wouldn't otherwise have. It gives him a credibility that he wouldn't otherwise have. For LeBron James, it gives him somebody who is now part of the number one broadcast crew with ESPN. And so he knows that however long he continues to play, he's going to have somebody in his corner on every national broadcast. JJ, at the same time, also has the value of he knows he's got access to LeBron. And I can tell you, as someone who worked at ESPN for 14 years, that having access and ESPN knowing that you have access to certain high-profile players can be a very valuable thing in your pocket. They revere that. So it works for both of them. How well it works as a podcast, that's the question I have for all of you. Because by all accounts, it has been a wild success. The first episode, which dropped 3 weeks ago, has, last I checked, some 3.6 million views on YouTube. And the next two episodes, the next one had like 2 million, and the one after that has 1 million. So they have dropped off somewhat, but that's still a lot. And you figure everybody's going to sample early, and then how much you retain, there's sort of a natural drop off, especially when you start that big. I'd say what I like best about it, and I haven't listened to every episode, but I've already listened to more than I ever thought I would, is how JJ has found ways to be self-deprecating that have convinced LeBron to get a little vulnerable as well. For example, getting LeBron to admit that he watches highlight reels of himself on YouTube. That is absolute gold in the sports media space and something normally that you wouldn't expect LeBron would give up. What I'm tickled by is them presenting the game in a way that inflates the intellect required to play it. It's the use of verbiage that makes it sound as if the game has been reinvented or is being played in the Matrix. Now, this is a habit that you can find in almost any field. Bankers do it. It's insider lingo. Bankers do it. Real estate people do it. Yes, even writers and broadcasters, we do it. And no doubt, I have been guilty, especially early on in my career, of using $20 words when a 50-cent version would have worked as well or better. Attempts to sound smart or, you know, smarter than the average bear. What amazes me, I suppose, is when players already regarded as smart about the game or highly accomplished seem to feel the need to publicly flex not just how smart they are, but how smart you have to be to play the game. I first experienced this with Michael Jordan in listening to one of his press conferences, and he used a word, and I can't remember if it was supercilious or insidious. It was a word like that, but he misused it. And I was thinking, Michael Jordan is reaching to use a word that's not really in his vocabulary in order to sound smart. And why would Michael Jordan have to do that? Who is Michael Jordan trying to impress? This was Michael Jordan at the height of his powers and fame and success. And I've seen it since, and I feel as if this podcast is a little bit of that. So maybe I'm underselling the mental capacity required, but you don't have to be that smart to play the game. You have to be observant and aware and disciplined and have a high degree of hand-eye coordination. But pure intellect, it's not physics. There are physics involved, to be sure, but no one playing has to identify the forces at work, the actual physics of how it works. It's why whenever we start talking about geniuses in sport, I can't help but roll my eyes a little bit. Any case, what inspired all this was the use of the term court mapping to describe Nikola Jokic's positioning the other Nuggets so that he could either go one-on-one or draw a double team that would leave a teammate open for an easy pass and score. And a quick note about Jokic's first name. Having been to Serbia, I've pronounced it Nikola from the time that he came into the league. And it wasn't too long ago that I had a listener rip me for that pronunciation, insisting that it was Nikola. And so I started listening to how others pronounced it, including the Nuggets radio announcer, and he was saying Nikola. So I changed up. And then I received a note, someone who claims to be Serbian, who said my original pronunciation, Nikola, was the way to say it. I was actually on Undisputed the other morning, and I said Nikola, and then corrected myself and said Nikola. And he was like, you got it right the first time. So I just did a deep dive, and I discovered that me and my new Serbian friend are correct. It's Nikola, and it's going to be Nikola from now on. And whoever the knucklehead was that ripped me, you know, forget it. Yeah. Anyway, back to court mapping. Speaking of language and manipulating it, I'd never heard of this term before. I've never heard anyone in the NBA ever used the term before. And as you well know, I've been around the game for a while. Now, I love words, and basketball does have a language all its own, and I love the basketball language. I love the shorthand of hoops. But this struck me as trying to make a strategy that has been around forever and is routinely employed by every playmaker or floor leader, floor general, whatever you want to call them, of any worth at various levels of the game, sound like we've just come up with an ingenious invention. Whether it's Jokic coming up with it or JJ and LeBron being able to recognize it. Particularly at this point in the history of the NBA, when the game has been simplified to the most basic level when it comes to space.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Which is essentially what Jokic was doing. He was just making sure that the Nuggets had the proper spacing to exploit the opponent's personnel. In this case, he had a smaller defender on him that he knew he could back down into the paint and force Aaron Gordon's defender, in this case, to come help and leave Gordon open for an easy lob and dunk. Or Jokic would simply back his way and have a little jump hook over the smaller defender. What JJ found so amazing is that Jokic made sure Gordon's side of the floor was clear, so there was no one to help if his man helped on Jokic. This was the court mapping. And I see some of this in my social media feed as well. Names I don't recognize are advertising clips of plays run by teams, and they use all the usual jargon: horns twist, flare cut, fill cut, hammer action, floppy. I don't know that it's really necessary to explain the play, but it's used. And it makes these standard plays sound extraordinary. Or they're crediting the execution of the play for creating baskets that are, if you watch the clip, are really the result of just awful defense. So here's my question. Do you guys find all of this stuff insightful or new? Do you like hearing the terminology, even if it isn't always clear exactly what it's referring to? And if those are two yeses, then I'm the one who needs to adjust his attitude. And who knows, maybe I'll do more of that. In any case, let me know. All right, so one other item from the podcast that gave me great insight, the Mind the Game podcast, that gave me great insight into LeBron and why I disagree with his perspective so often, is that he detailed all the time that he puts into staying in shape and getting his rest and honing his game, about the time and commitment required to be great and the sacrifice that it requires, and how family and loved ones don't always understand the sacrifice that is being made. And I have an entirely different perspective on that. And it's why it took me a long time to get married and start a family, because I was focused on my career. I didn't have time for any of that. I knew I didn't have any time for any of that. It wasn't until I was at ESPN for a couple of years, I got married to a woman who was an athlete but not a sports fan, didn't really know what I did, knew that I was on TV, knew that I was a writer. That was about it. Didn't come home and talk a lot about the job, which was just fine with me. It was great, actually. And we had kids in short order, and my work and my job then became, almost overnight, became a vehicle for me giving them a good life, not for me to climb some imaginary ladder. It's ultimately what led me to leave ESPN, because I got to the point that doing the job the way I felt it needed to be done conflicted with how I wanted to be as a husband and a dad. And so that's when I decided I couldn't work for ESPN anymore. And if this any of this sounds preachy or condescending, I do not mean it like that at all. I'm just telling you my experience. And it really was a transformation that I went through from being all about my job and in many ways all about myself to, I've said it, getting married and having kids, it made me unselfish in a way that I don't know anything else could. And this is where LeBron and I have fundamentally different views of pursuing greatness. Because I believe that greatness in and of itself, you're chasing something that is ultimately illusory. Because the hierarchy of greatness is crowdsourced. Who is the greatest is not up for those who are reaching for it to decide in almost anything that we talk about. Greatest movie actor, greatest hedge fund leader, greatest athlete, greatest musician, you name it. Especially, I think, in the arts. The latter, as I said, that I was climbing is imaginary. And we don't determine how high on that ladder we ultimately reach. The world tells us. And it doesn't mean that the world's right, but that's generally how what rung you're on is determined. The other element that LeBron and I disagree on when it comes to chasing greatness is who is making the greatest sacrifice. It's not the person chasing the greatness. Chasing greatness is essentially a selfish act. Now, I am still trying to be the best version of me today that I can be. I'm still trying to do the best work I can do. I still have goals and ambition that include being able to say that what I did was the best. But while I may have to sacrifice certain personal pleasures to do the work, what I've become aware of is that the greatest sacrifice is by my wife and kids and friends when it requires them to take care of things or deprives them of time or attention that I'd otherwise have for them. Because they don't get anything out of my obsession to be great and all that that requires. I mean, maybe a few material benefits, but the idea that their lives are improved by some accolades or praise or celebrity that I have, I consider that self-absorption at the highest level. So in a way, they deserve credit because they allow me to chase whatever greatness I'm chasing. And then there are my colleagues and mentors and employers who have helped me do what I do. And so as I've gotten older, I've come to realize that this is very much, no matter what I'm trying to do, it's very much a team effort. And that I owe a lot of people for my success, any success that I might have. Success that I might have is very much a collective achievement. And I'm just not sure that LeBron would agree with me on that, and he certainly did not speak on this podcast as if that is his point of view. All right, now, finally, on to what is happening with the 2024 NBA draft. There's more that I could say about the podcast. There's some rewriting of history. I think some others have pointed that out. There's another benefit from LeBron doing it, which is that he gets to kind of tell in hindsight, revise a little bit of how things went on or portray them in a certain light. I've said enough about the podcast. Check it out. I think it's a plus to have it in the circle of media that we're able to consume. I just am not going to look at it as being 100% what I would hope that a LeBron podcast would be. In any case, the 2024 NBA draft, which is being advertised by some as one of, if not the worst ever. Comparisons have been made to 2013 when the Cleveland Cavaliers selected Anthony Bennett number one, and the 14 lottery picks produced exactly one all-star, and that would be Victor Oladipo. As of today, that entire draft class has produced a total of three all-stars: Oladipo, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Rudy Gobert. That's the fewest All-Stars from any draft class from 2008 to 2018. The 2019 class also has had three All-Stars to date, but they were all within the first five picks of the draft. Zion Williamson, Ja Morant, and Darius Garland. So if it wasn't chock full of talent, at least the talent that was there was identifiable, and everybody was picking it as soon as they could. It was picked at the top of the draft. That's the way a draft normally works. But the problem here is not so much that there's no talent in this draft. It's not simply that it doesn't have any clear-cut franchise cornerstone, guaranteed future all-star, or generational-type players. That's not the problem. That's not what makes this draft bad for GMs and scouts. It's that they know this draft class, like every other one, will produce at least three all-stars, if not the usual half dozen. And they have no idea who those three or half dozen might be. That is the problem. That is a recipe for looking bad, which is a recipe for GMs and scouts to lose their jobs. And why, you ask, might it be harder to discern who those all-stars or top players are in this draft? Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that the top talent is mostly young players overseas, teenagers overseas. For all the advances in global scouting, for all the success of guys like Nikola Jokic and Luka Doncic and Giannis Antetokounmpo, there is still a built-in bias about how well foreign players will adapt to the NBA. Put it this way. There's never been a more accomplished international player than Doncic, despite still being a teenager. And yet DeAndre Ayton, Marvin Bagley, the two players ahead of him, hadn't accomplished anything remotely close collegiately to what Doncic had done already professionally in Europe, and yet they went ahead of him. And then he was traded for Trae Young and a lousy protected first-round pick. The Atlanta Hawks were lucky enough for Luka Doncic to still be there when they picked, and they took him and promptly dealt him so they could get an extra pick. And I don't say that to bag on the Hawks as much as to say that's just a reflection of how cynical NBA teams are about international talent. And this was just 5 years ago. And I have to reiterate, if there was ever an international player to bet on and take number one before Victor Wembanyama, it was Luka Doncic. Not even Yao Ming was anywhere near as credentialed as Luka was going into that draft. And no, Victor going number one isn't an indication that the NBA has wisened up. The American options in the last draft were just so clearly less appealing that there was no way anyone could have passed on him or would be ranked ahead of him. This year in particular, there's also a built-in issue with arguably the best foreign player and likeliest number one pick, Alexander Sarr. And if anybody wants to tell me that I'm mispronouncing that name, please, please have at it. In any case, Sarr is a Frenchman who's playing in the Australian League. And for whatever reason, the Aussie League is not seen or regarded as a particularly good league, despite producing, especially of late, a host of quality NBA players. Josh Giddey, Jock Landale, and Dante Exum, who left the NBA, played in Australia for a year, and then came back a much better player. That doesn't happen unless there's a quality competition to sharpen you. A GM told me just the other day that the bias is a result of simply having more personnel in organizations that are looking at U.S.-based talent versus scouting overseas. It's kind of human nature. We love what we know and we hate what we don't. Everybody in an organization, meanwhile, not only has a stake in their opinion being right, but in their opinion being acted upon. And if you have 20 people that are scouting U.S. talent and five that are looking at overseas players. There's a natural bias because you're going to have a louder U.S. chorus. The other issue is that thanks to COVID and NIL deals, players have been staying in school longer. And the result of that is the normal one-and-done talent coming in isn't getting the same kind of playing time or roles. And so there's less intel on exactly what they're capable of. And so all of that has made, one, the mock drafts pure guessing game, even more of a guessing game than usual. And one executive told me that some of that is going to expose the weaker front offices who like to crowdsource where they're going to go in the draft. To look at it, or GMs in particular, look at it as the guy that I'm going to draft that I won't get fired if he doesn't pan out. I'm going with the popular pick. And believe it or not, that kind of stuff does happen. There is a healthy number of people in the NBA who are looking to not necessarily make the right move as much as make the move that protects their job. Because there's a big difference between working and drawing an NBA paycheck and doing just about anything else in basketball. It's a sweet life, and people will do almost anything to stay in it. And if it's a matter of, am I going to take a risk? Am I going to roll the dice? Am I going to go for broke, even though it could cost me my job? Or can I play it safe? There are plenty of people out there that are going to play it safe. And on some level, I really can't blame them. We each have our own path to trod, if you will. So the last part about how this NBA draft is affecting things, you've probably seen it already, in that Drew Holiday got signed to an extended contract, 4 years, even at, what, age 33, 34. And Grayson Allen just got a 4-year deal. I believe that you're going to see, and I've been told, you're going to see more of that because the unknowns of the young players, even in the last couple of drafts. I didn't mention them, but we've only had one all-star from the last couple of drafts. Some of that is normal because it takes a while for players to establish themselves as all-star talents. But some of that is because it's just taking longer for players to develop for some of the reasons that I explained and some of the reasons that have led to this draft not being looked at as very talent-laden, if you will, or known talent-laden. So teams are more likely to look at what they have and say, let me stock up on what I have. Let me secure what I have because I don't know if there's talent out there to replace it. And I don't want to be one of those teams that is looking for that talent or needing that talent. And I'm counting on the draft or some young player to develop to make that happen. You can even look at the situation with the Golden State Warriors and their guys, Jonathan Kuminga and Moses Moody. Those are high draft picks. Those are guys that physically had the requisite ability to play in the NBA. And yet it's taking them years to get to a point where they can actually contribute. And you could point to the Warriors' struggles or their downfall as that being part of it in terms of those guys not coming along at the pace that you would normally hope. So, all right, that does it for this episode of On the Ball on the United WeCast Network. Please rate and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And speaking of the Warriors, I do want to take a look at where they are and where they're headed and give you a realistic expectation of what the Warriors could and should be over the next few years and what they're most likely to do as they move forward with an aging core and some young talent that shows some potential. But at this point, obviously, for where they are in the finishing 10th in the Western Conference has not delivered to the level that Warriors fans expect. And then, of course, we have all sorts of other things to size up with. The awards, just finished filling out my award ballot. Was given less than 24 hours by the league to do that without knowing that it was going to be less than 24 hours or when the deadline ultimately was going to be. We'll talk a little bit about that and how that may have impacted some of the voting, not necessarily by me, but I think voting overall. Lots of things to get to. And so expect another podcast episode to drop before the end of this week. In the meantime, as always, thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.